Can breast density be used to inform how often mammograms should be done?
A new therapy for essential tremor.
Reducing sugar consumption for kids.
And can we use genetic testing to guide breast cancer therapy?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on August 26th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should jump right to circulation. This ongoing debate about sugar, now circulation has stepped into it and said, hey, parents, 6 teaspoons, hey folks, that's teaspoons, not tablespoons, of sugar is appropriate for children to consume each day.
For listeners that may not be familiar, Circulation is the journal of the American Heart Association. And in this particular issue, they're weighing in on added sugars in children. The average child between the ages of 2 and 19 consumes about 80 grams of sugar per day as added sugar. In the analysis of the literature, they found that that was clearly associated with increased caloric intake, obesity, increased lipids. These are all risk factors for cardiovascular disease and subsequently cardiovascular death, which is a major cause of death in the United States. They suggest that the amount of added sugar that was recommended previously by either nutritional guidelines or the United States Preventative Services Task Force, USPSTF, was way too high. And they're recommending that we limit it to just 25 grams of sugar. That's a third of what the kids are currently eating. And in fact, they take it further. Since exposure to added sugars before the age of 2 is clearly associated with childhood obesity, they're recommending no added sugars for children less than 2. Now, what does 25 grams mean? That means 1 8-ounce sweetened beverage per week, not per day, but per week.
This, of course, is one of those seemingly draconian kinds of recommendations that I think is going to be really hard to implement.
It's only hard because over the last 15 or 20 years, we've changed our dietary habits to make these a part of our routine diet. But if you go back 20 or 25 years ago, kids weren't drinking as many beverages. They weren't eating as many cookies or cakes. The diet was healthier. Now that 2/3 of adults are overweight, 1/3 are frankly obese, about 15% are morbidly obese, we've seen the increase in cardiovascular disease. And what this highlights is this starts early. It starts in childhood, and we need to address it in children.
That's such a powerful message. I think we're going to leave that one with that. And I would just add that I clearly am in favor of reducing added sugars in everything and refined carbohydrates for that matter.
I couldn't have said it better.
Okay.
Where do you want to go next, Elizabeth?
Let's turn to this issue of the predictive value of breast density with regard to how often women need to have a mammogram. That's in Annals of Internal Medicine.
As you know, there's been a lot of controversy about the routine use of mammograms, especially in women under the age of 40. There's general consensus that between the ages of 50 and 74, routine mammography can decrease breast cancer mortality. And the current recommendation is to have it done biannually, that is every other year. That doesn't take into account that women have different risk factors with regard to their breast density. The more dense a breast is, the more likely there is for that woman to develop cancer over the subsequent years. So what these investigators did was, using available data, they did modeling to look at women that were clinically thought to be either at low risk, immediate risk, or high risk, and then ask a simple question: does looking at breast density provide any additional information that can inform of how often women should have mammography done? And here's what they discovered. For women that are considered to be low risk, if they have primarily fatty tissue in their breast, having mammograms done every 3 years gave the same results in terms of reducing breast cancer mortality, but it did decrease overdiagnosis and false positives. What about women that are considered to be intermediate risk or high risk? Breast density can push their mammograms to be done annually. What this informs us is not just clinical risk factors, but what's found on the mammogram can help decide whether mammography should be done every year, 2 years, or 3 years.
Of course, I need to reflect that mammography just by itself is just such a really not fun thing to do. So I would think that women would really welcome the opportunity to not have it as often as it's generally recommended. I wonder if women are really going to adopt that practice.
That's a good point. And the other thing is, what this means is that you have to be able to assess the risk, have some measurement of breast density already, and then combine the two.
And clearly all of this moving us much more toward this personalized precision medicine objective that is front and center for us at the moment.
Yeah. And in fact, most women fall into that category. They're either considered to be at low risk and have low density. And so this would apply to a large number of women.
Excellent. Since we're talking about breast cancer, now let's move to the New England Journal of Medicine. The utility of a genetic analysis, really taking a look at a large number of loci and its predictive value in early breast cancer with regard to treatment.
When women develop early stage breast cancer, whether or not to proceed with chemotherapy, that is after the cancer has been removed, what's called adjuvant chemotherapy, to prevent recurrence or to prevent distant metastasis, depends upon whether a woman is considered to be at low or high risk. Currently, if a woman is considered to be at high risk, she has adjuvant chemotherapy. If she's considered to be at low risk, she's not. Well, can we add genetic testing to that to further decide whether chemotherapy is beneficial? So the authors attempted to address this by looking at almost 6,700 women with early stage breast cancer to see whether they were clinically at low or high risk, and then to use the genetic testing. Well, here's what they discovered. In women considered to be at high risk based on clinical factors, but genetic testing suggested they'd be at low risk, if they did not receive chemotherapy, they had about a 93% chance at 5 years of being disease-free and to have survived. And you say, well, that's pretty good. Well, here's the kicker. That same group, if you receive chemotherapy, your chance of being alive without distant metastasis was 94.5%. Now you say, well, they're very similar. It's about a 1.5% difference. This is important because for a woman, she has to decide whether the chemotherapy are worth that extra 1.5% additional benefit.
I think that that's one point. I think the other point about this is it suggests that the genetic testing is not as complete as it needs to be, or that there might be additional factors that I'm going to identify epigenetics, for example, as potentially informative with regard to these clinical decisions.
And this, as you described, this is a 70 gene signature test. We will become better and we'll be better able to deliver what is called precision or personalized medicine as we refine these things.
Yeah, I guess the other piece of data I'd like to have, and this is the last thing I'll say about this study, is, well, what happens if you don't have it? Hey, for those women who choose to forego initial chemotherapy and they recur, how effective are we at treating that?
That's a good point. The other point, Elizabeth, that this study didn't address was women that have BRCA genes. So this is one piece of the puzzle, but there's still additional studies that need to be done.
And that's good because it's job security for us. Finally, then, let's turn to something that resonates for me because I've seen so many people be so troubled by this. This condition that's called essential tremor, it can actually really impact somebody's life in a very deleterious way. And a new way of treating it, that's also in the New England Journal of Medicine.
I was unaware that nearly 7 million people in the United States suffer from essential tremor. Well, I usually think about it affecting the arms and the hands. In some individuals, it affects the body, the head, even the voice in some individuals. We have some medications that are marginally effective, using propranolol or primidone, for example. But in essence, many of these individuals have medically refractory essential tremor. The therapy that is approved right now is deep brain stimulation. That is putting electrodes through a burr in the brain into an area of the brain called the thalamus that controls these tremors. And by adjusting the stimulation, many of these individuals can receive relief. But that therapy is associated with some risks, some intracranial bleeding and infection. And so there's been an attempt to find other types of therapies that don't have these risks. And one of these is using ultrasound or sound waves that are targeted toward the thalamus, delivered outside the brain. The investigators looked at 76 individuals that had had essential tremor for an average of about 17 years and treated them with either ultrasound or a sham procedure. 3 months after the procedure, those that received the ultrasound thalamotomy had a 50% improvement in their tremors. If you look over the next 9 months, there was a 20% decrease in improvement. There were some individuals, about 10 to 15%, that had persistent gait problems and or paresthesias. In this particular case, you make a complete lesion in the brain. That is, you cut off a part of the thalamus. And so some of these individuals had long-term neurologic side effects.
Even so, though, it's hopeful because to me suggests a direction that's less invasive and that could potentially really improve the quality of life for these folks. Because, of course, this condition continues to degenerate.
It does. Again, I want to highlight this will be effective only if we have long-term follow-up that suggests that the results last longer than 3 months or 6 months or 12 months. Because if we're going to create a permanent lesion that's associated with side effects, we don't have long-term benefits, then I'd say it's not as beneficial as deep brain stimulation.
I think that right now that is a valid argument, but as we know, all of these technologies improve over time.
You're right. So this is a proof of concept and it will get better. If we can deliver this more precisely, so we can avoid the side effects and deliver it in a way that we get long-term effects, then it will be beneficial.
Excellent. On that note, I think this week I'm going to talk about reducing sugar consumption for children in circulation. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.